This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, y'all, from NPR, I'm Sam Sanders. It's been a minute. If you are hearing my voice right now, you survived Thanksgiving. I am proud of you. Give yourself a round of applause, a pat on the back. You made it through a lot. Relatives talking politics at the table, long lines at the grocery store, oven mishaps, your Aunt Ruth's potato salad. You made it. And now you deserve a break. A little slice of feel good, a few laughs. Listener, that's what we are giving you this episode. We're going to highlight some interviews I've done with comedians over the last year or so. First up, a couple of stories from comedians on their way up, struggling just to make it. Long before he was the star of The Oath and shows like Eastbound and Down and The Mindy Project, Ike Barinholtz was a college dropout. He left Boston University, moved back home to Chicago. He was doing improv at night, and he had a day job to make ends meet.
I loved school.
Sure you
but
did.
But I hated studying. And so I
That's
loved,
not how it works.
I know. But I loved my teachers. Yeah. I loved talking to my teachers.
All right.
I loved Boston. But BU just wasn't for me. And I think I went through and there was a bit of a you're fired, I quit situation with the school. And then I went back home to Chicago. And my parents were pretty, you know, freaked out because they, you know, obviously wanted the best for me, and they knew I liked acting a little bit. So my dad took me to the Improv Olympics 25th, or no, sorry, it was the 15th anniversary show at the Vic Theater. And I'd never seen real improv before. And I went and I was just blown away. That was an epiphanal moment where I was like, okay, I'm feeling something. I remember seeing Amy Poehler and Adam McKay. And the person really who was so funny, he came out and did this scene. And it was Tim Meadows.
Oh, yeah.
And he came out and was and did the scene. And
the ladies' man.
The ladies' man. And he was so funny in the scene. And it, to be honest, the scene didn't even get a lot of laughs, but it was so he was using the very specific references that use. And he was getting some laughs off of it. And I thought, oh, my, I could do this. I could see myself doing this. So it was, I think the next week, I signed up for classes at I.O. and Second City and the Annoyance Theater, which is this great kind
of renegade.
You signed
up for class at three.
I signed up at all three.
Wow.
Yeah, I completely jumped in. I had a day job, but I every night.
What was the day job?
I was working for the Chicago Transit Authority.
I read that.
Yeah, I was working for the marketing department.
You drove Valerie Jarrett around?
I did drive Valerie. I did.
Valerie Jarrett, who was a senior advisor to Barack Obama when he was in the White House. But before that, when she was in Chicago with CTA, she was the...
She was the chairwoman of the CTA.
Ah,
yeah,
okay.
She was the chairwoman. And every once in a while, when she would kind of come in, I would go and pick her up. And I don't know why we didn't take the train. But,
yeah.
But, you know, but...
Was she cool?
Yeah, she was. She was, you know, I was like a 18-year-old idiot listening to Howard Stern on my transistor radio. I didn't know, you know. It was so funny, too, because at the same time, there's this gym, kind of nice gym right around the corner from the CTA. CTA's in the Merchandise Mart, and behind there's this really beautiful gym called the East Bank Club. And they have two full basketball courts. I love basketball.
Yeah.
And I would go on my lunch break or I'd go after work, and me and all my friends would play. And
stop.
Yeah.
Barack Obama.
Yeah.
I hear he's not actually that good at basketball.
No, he's not bad.
You have to say that.
Because he's a dear friend. He wasn't bad. He wasn't like, a stud on the court. But we just saw him all the time. And I think one time I asked him, I was like, are you a politician? And he's like, I'm a local rep. I'm working. And I got bored. You know, I was like, I'll see you never. He did yell at my partner one time, though.
Why?
Because he went up and my partner kind of hacked him. And I'm gonna curse. So
do it.
But he comes down and points his finger at my friend's
face. This is
Obama. This is President Barack Obama. And he goes, don't undercut me, kid. Don't do that again. And I was like... And now, like, then cut to 2002. My dad's like, "Hey, I think he's going to be our senator. He's great. We love him." And then I watched him do that 2004 speech.
Oh,
it's this defining moment in American politics. This man is speaking from the heart and creating a movement. And all I can think of is, "Don't undercut me, kid." But anyway, so I was doing that during the day, and then at night I would take classes, and on the weekend took I was a busboy at Second City, and I would, you know, wipe up the vomit from the kids that puke because they drank too much.
Then
I would watch Tina Fey, and I would watch Rachel Dratch and Brian Stack, all these great performers, and I really, you know, I just kind of immersed myself in the Chicago improv community, which is really that's my acting school, that's my training, that's where I come from.
Yeah. Our time is coming to a close, but I promise the next time you're on the show, you're going to tell me all about the crazy adventures you, Seth Meyers, Jordan Peele, Jason Sudeikis got into when you did sketch comedy in Amsterdam?
Amsterdam, Holland.
Make that a movie.
We're trying to. It's right now.
Really?
It's a hard NC-17. No, I eventually it could be like a fun movie, but it was... That was a theater called Boom Chicago. And
why were they in Amsterdam?
Well, it was three guys who were... Northwestern students, and they were backpacking through Holland, and they were like, we love it here, but the comedy's terrible. Let's do a Second City style show here. So they called it, you know, Chicago for Chicago, and boom, no one knows why. It's such a weird name. But and it started off just the three of these guys in the back of a bar. And by the time I got there, you know, in 99, it was big. It was a dinner theater through 200-300 seats, and the prime minister would come, and it was crazy. It was
Did they laugh at jokes as much as we do up there?
They don't laugh as hard as we do.
Okay.
They're very honest.
All right.
You know, after the show, they would make us go and talk to the audience, go and schmooze. Literally, in your contract, you'd schmooze.
Really?
And those Dutchmen, you know, Americans, you'll be like, I loved it. And like, oh, what was your favorite part? The whole thing was great.
Yeah.
And the Dutch are just like, the show was not bad. Your black friend was very funny. You had the song that did not was not good. But will I come back? Possibly. So it was like that. You're like, thank you.
That was Ike Barinholtz. We talked just a few weeks ago as his movie The Oath was coming out. Ike wrote and directed that film, and he starred in it as well alongside Tiffany Haddish. You can check out the entire episode in our podcast feed to hear more about what Tiffany is like on set. All right, you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders. All this episode, we are sharing a few of my favorite moments with comedians / comedic actors here on the show. Another incredible story of struggling on the way up, also in Chicago as it happens, came to us from Timothy Simons. You know Timothy as Jonah Ryan on the hit HBO comedy Veep. But long before that show, Timothy was a struggling actor living in Chicago, where he worked a lot of odd jobs.
I worked backstage at the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, and that sort of got me into this world where I was a stage carpenter for a long time. I would, like, audition for plays at night and try to, like, be in rehearsal at night, and I would build sets during the day. And then when I started focusing more on on-camera stuff, I needed to have my days free, so I started working at bars, and I was a bouncer at Joe's on Weed in Chicago, which on the Colbert Show, I did in fact say it is the worst bar in America. And I want to let your listeners know that I stand by that statement.
Okay.
Their Chicago Trib wrote an article a couple days after, or the day after. And the last paragraph was, we reached out to Joe's on Weed for comment, and we have not heard back. And I just love that I was able to troll them so many years later. It's the worst job I've ever had.
Really?
Because everybody, I don't know if you've seen me, like, at the time, I was probably 6'5", 180. And I'm not kidding, I was the biggest dude on that staff.
Why?
Everybody
Who was the manager of security? Joe's on Weed.
They didn't have one.
Okay.
Their thought process was, we're not going to get them with size because it's such a big bar.
Yeah.
It was like, we're not going to get them with size. We're going to pay 25 people $6 an hour. So if something did happen, we would literally just overwhelm whatever it was with bodies.
You know what? Okay. It's like, would you rather fight a horse-sized duck
or 100 duck-sized
horses.
We were 100 duck-sized horses going after these dudes at, like, this weird Midwestern country bar that also had hip-hop shows.
Hip-hop shows,
and
too. Okay.
One of my first nights working was a Ghostface Killa show. And
wow. Just him or Al Wu-Tang?
No, just him. Just
okay.
Ghostface.
Okay.
And he had opening acts.
Okay.
It was all going fine. It was running really late. Like, Ghostface, like, I mean, he was supposed to go on, I think, at, like, 10:30 or 11, and nobody had even heard from him. Like, he was not only not going on, he wasn't anywhere to be found. And so like the whole night had started late. They rolled out the opening acts a little bit late, and people were not super happy about how long it was going.
Yeah.
And so I told this story on Colbert, and there was something that, and the reason I bring that up is because something happened afterwards, which was really fun. Mm. So after Colbert, not after the riot.
Gotcha.
So basically,
a phrase I've never said myself, after the riot. I love that.
Not after the riot, after Colbert. So
you haven't told me why they riot.
Opening act comes on, okay. a New York City hip-hop duo, and one of them, I think maybe the crowd wasn't super into his songs,
uh-huh.
And so he got upset, and I think his exact words were, "F*** Chicago hip-hop, I'm all about New York City," from what I remember.
Fighting words.
And we were serving glass bottles that night.
First mistake.
And immediately, they started raining down on stage.
Oh, my God.
And one of the guys in the band, I don't think the guy, somebody, a bartender told me this later, somebody reached behind the bar and grabbed a tequila bottle, like a full Cuervo tequila bottle, and hucked it at the stage. And it hit the other guy in the face. The other guy in the duo in the face. He runs off stage.
Lord.
The whole place lights up.
Oh, my God.
Somebody, I find this out, I was reminded of this later, that somebody took a couch and threw it from the balcony onto the first floor.
And here you were thinking Boston was bad.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I mean, at some point, 14 cops showed up. I was wearing a shirt that said Joe's on Weed on it, and I asked my manager, like, what I should do, and he said he didn't know. And so I just... Or stop it. Like, somehow he was like, I don't know, just stop it. And so I just took the shirt off and I turned it inside out and just pretended like I was at the show. And I joined in with the riot because I was not, like, the duck-sized horses could not overwhelm this.
What kind of rioter were you? Were you a glass thrower? Were you a sofa thrower? Were you a puncher?
Oh, shit, that reminds me. I did get punched in the face. I did get punched in the face before, and I think that was the final straw where I was like, F*** this. I'm getting paid $6 an hour. I'm not getting punched in the face for that. And so I think what I was more of like a yeller and a fist in the air kind of rioter.
Me
like,
too.
I'm just trying to like egg. I wasn't going to destroy something at my place of business.
Yeah, you're just the instigator.
My place of work. I wasn't going to instigate any. I was just like, yeah, you should throw that couch. Yeah, like that sort of thing. And so I tell this story on Colbert, and I come backstage, and the musical act that night was, I believe, the Dan Auerbach Band, like side project from the Black Keys.
Yeah, yeah.
I say that was with a question mark because I don't,
like you don't
follow
know.
Music. I'm like, the Black Keys?
The Black Keys?
The Black Keys? And he goes, hey, man, I was running the soundboard at Joe's on Weed that night, and we spent 15 minutes going, like, this was one of the things that, like, in the story I'd said, like, oh yeah, the couch had gone from the first floor or from the second, the balcony down to the second floor, and he was like, you're not wrong, but you're not right. It got thrown off the balcony, but it, like, got wedged in between, like, the bow truss of this building and the balcony, so it was kind of just stuck halfway between the balcony in the first floor.
That's a better option than, like, it hitting someone. So I'll take that.
Yeah. No, 100%.
And we should close the story by saying, you know, like, neither of us condone violence.
Of course.
In any way.
Of course. It's not, violence is never funny 15 years later.
Timothy Simons, he plays Jonah Ryan on the HBO comedy Veep. That show is coming back for a 7th and final season next spring. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders. All this episode, we are sharing a few of my favorite moments with comedians here on the show. All right, time for a break. When we come back, not one, not two, but three alums of Saturday Night Live with three very different takes on the show, and one of them spills some tea about that time Donald Trump hosted. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas has re-engineered socks for ultimate comfort by getting rid of that annoying toe sink, adding arch support, and using some of the world's softest cotton. And for every pair purchased, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. To date, they've sold and donated over 10 million pairs. To feel the Bombas difference, go to bombas.com/minute for 20% off your first order.
Support also comes from Buffy, the comforter made better for you and the earth. Buffy uses natural eucalyptus to create a soothing, silk-soft fabric and rejuvenates recycled bottles into a cloud-like fill, all to create a comforter with 4.8 stars across 13,000 reviews without cruelty or waste. Visit Buffy.co to experience the complimentary 30-night trial and use code NPR to save $20 on your purchase.
How often do people lie on dating apps? And are robots taking over our jobs? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of Planet Money's The Indicator, where every day we tell you a short story about the economy. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders. Today, we are sharing a few of my favorite moments with comedians here on the show. And when you talk to comics, the one thing that always comes up over and over again is one show, Saturday Night Live. We're going to hear two former SNL cast members in just a bit, Taryn Killam and Sasheer Zamata. But first, we're going to hear from SNL alum Natasha Rothwell. She used to write on the show. She is now a writer, actor, and producer on HBO's Insecure. But a few years back, she got the call to audition to be on SNL. What she did not know was that this was not going to be any normal audition. It was actually a secret audition for only black women. This was the result of ongoing and very loud criticism of the show's record on diversity. Here's Natasha talking about that strange audition and what she learned from her time on SNL.
Well, here's the thing. For me, doing comedy in New York, for most people who do comedy in New York, yeah. I'll speak generally,
yeah.
They have sort of their crosshairs set on being on SNL.
That is the Holy Grail.
That's the Holy Grail. That was not my case because of said yeah. issues with their casting.
Yeah.
I had not seen myself reflected in mm-hmm. the cast yeah. or someone who looked like me
exactly.
on the cast. I'll rephrase that. And so...
Because I'm like, in thinking of black women, Maya Rudolph,
yes.
another black woman from way back in the day.
Yes.
But it was like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so for me, I was just like, you know, I don't want to feel like running my head against a wall that I knew that was sort of impenetrable. And so while I was on that grind,
yeah.
I was contacted by the artistic director at the time at the People's Improv Theater and said, listen, mm-hmm. SNL reached out to me. They're doing this audition. And they asked me who I think should be a part of it. And I said, you. And I was like, okay.
Did it feel weird?
Yes.
It's like this is the Underground Railroad audition. What's
yeah.
the world?
I didn't, to be honest, like me being completely wide-eyed and naive, I showed up and I thought it was just going to be a multicultural, like,
oh.
I didn't know it was just like black women. Until I'm backstage. I was backstage. I was like, what kind of utopia is this? I was like, this is heaven. I remember we took a picture, which like got leaked somehow.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this, I've never, all of us talked about how we're always the only one.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
when we're on our Herald teams or if we're showing up for different things up uh-huh. until that point, there'd be a black person.
Yeah.
Maybe a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
Not a room full of talented, funny black women.
Yeah. But then they bring you together. And
like, they bring us
kiki
together.
Kiki to kiki, but
yeah.
now you got to compete.
Yeah, like to the death.
In
right?
the Comedy Hunger Games.
In the Comedy Hunger Games. But I, when I, here's the thing. uh-huh. Like, I'm like 1,000% like was... At the point when someone's just like, here's a party that you definitely weren't going to be invited to, but now you have a special invitation, you dress up. Like, you get
yeah.
dressed, you, like, get ready. So
oh,
I was
yeah.
like, okay, I'm going to really try to go after this. But I remember seeing everyone backstage, and I hit a point emotionally where I was just like, I don't think I'm what they're looking for. And not for mm-hmm. my ability, but... Mm-hmm. They classically cast people who look like the imitations, like the impersonations that they'll do. And at the time, they were looking for a Michelle Obama. And I was like, that ain't me. But you know what I am? I'm funny.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm going to write and perform something that I think is very funny and that makes me laugh.
What did you perform?
I did impressions of Oprah, Maya Angelou. I did Keenan for Keenan was in the audience. And so I did a
you
Keenan.
You did Keenan?
I did Keenan for Keenan.
A little bit of Keenan.
It was completely silent, which is me doing all of his looks, which are just like, because
yes.
he does a lot of wide eyes to
oh,
the camera.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I just announced it, you know, I'm doing Keenan. And it was just...
I love it.
It was just a lot of like side looks. And I felt in that moment like a fearlessness with the audition because I was like, I've got nothing to lose. Mm. And I had a great audition. I felt really good about it. Mm. And that's what I want to have happen. And like everything else that happened after that was all a shock and awe campaign. Like, I had no idea.
Because then they came to you and said, you should write for us.
Yeah. They reached out to my manager at the time and they, well, now she's still my manager. I love her to death. Edna, what's up? She said that they contacted her and were just like, it was one of the best written auditions we'd seen. And would you come in for a meeting to write for the show? And it was another, I remember getting the call for that. And it was a long time.
Oh,
it
really?
Was a time enough for me to sort of grieve not getting it. Mm. Then that popped up again. So it was just a very, it was a back and forth of just like the hot, you know, the hot guy wants you. He don't want you. He called. You know,
yeah,
it's just like, you know, I don't want to mess
like,
with him.
I already blocked his number.
I blocked his number. Who's this? And then you're just like, okay, let me, you know, put on some makeup and see what he wants. So
yeah,
it was definitely that going into meet with the head writers and, you know, ultimately write for the show. Yeah.
I have interviewed now, you're my third interview with someone who used to be on that show, Dr. Taryn Killam.
Yeah.
Sasheer, who was just delightful. I got the feeling from both of them that their relationship with that show, even after being off it for a while, is conflicted. Was it a good experience for you? I wonder about what it's like to be there from what I've talked to folks about.
It's not easy. It's not easy. I'm appreciative of the time I, like, had there.
Yeah. How many years were you there?
I was just there for 1 year.
Okay.
It was season 40, which was a wild time to be there.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's meant to be easy.
Yeah.
I also think that being in a 40-year-old institution that is predominantly white as a woman of color, it's a different journey. And I'm not trying to sugarcoat it or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just, it's sort of at this point, my process with having been on the show and now sort of having hindsight, it's really sort of matter of fact where I learned a ton. I learned a ton. Mm-hmm. I was like working alongside amazing, smart, funny people. Mm-hmm. In an environment that wasn't for me. Like, some people thrive there.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, no shade, but it was just like, it wasn't for me. But at the time, I wanted, it's like you want the glass shoe to fit so badly.
Mm-hmm.
And you're bending your foot and you're trying to figure out how to fit in because you want it to be you. You want them to want you as much as you want them.
But you should never break your foot.
It shouldn't break your foot. Find something that fits. So find a nice, you know, easy shoe.
Yeah.
Something where it's just, you know, there's a comfort level there. And so.
Some naturalizer flip flops.
Yeah, that's right. Get some, like, you know, little low wedges. Nothing crazy.
That was Natasha Rothwell talking about how she got a job as a writer on SNL. She left the show a bit after a year. Now she plays Kelly on HBO's Insecure, where she is also a writer and producer. So you heard Natasha and I talk about that secret black woman audition at SNL. Another woman that was at that audition, and she was cast in the show after that night. Her name is Sasheer Zameida. She spent several seasons on the show before leaving in 2017. And she told me that she still confronts the issue of race all the time, on stage and off, particularly right now in this age of Donald Trump.
I think because it's like in our face more, something is in the air where it's like people who have maybe negative thoughts about race or class or gender or
love your
sexuality.
Maybe. Like, maybe they might be a little bit more racist.
Maybe a little racist. They're coming out.
They are.
They're
they
coming
are ready.
Out of the woodwork, and they feel comfortable to say whatever they want because other people in positions of power are doing that as well. So, yeah, I mean, I talk about it on stage. I talk about it with my friends. I think the more that we are open to talking about these things and the more aware people are, the more we'll be able to, like, combat it when we see it.
Yeah. Well, give me an example of like one of those convos now.
Well, actually, the other day I was because I on stage I'll talk about when people say I don't see color.
Yeah.
And like to me that feels so old. Like it feels like most people are over that statement.
Yeah.
But I like still have to explain to people why that's bad.
Yeah.
Like, I was like,
it's like slapping and say don't touch my hair.
Yeah.
Like we're still doing that.
Yeah. It's just saying how like I hate when people say I don't see color. Because it's a lie, first of all.
There's
you
that.
Can see a color.
There's that.
Even if you're colorblind, you can see shades.
Uh-huh.
And secondly, it's just trying to say, like, I choose not to see injustice, or I'd rather not be bothered with the information that some people are treated differently because of the way they look. And that's not helpful to anybody. It actually be helpful if we saw color and recognize how different people are being treated differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing how many times, because I've talked about this on stage, like, I do other interviews where they're like, but can't you just ignore it? Or like, well, what if you just didn't think about it? And I'm like, I can not think about it, but also, why would I do that? Why would I ignore it?
Exactly.
And
I could pretend that, like, STDs aren't a thing.
Yeah, but then, like, but then I'm at risk, you know? Like,
exactly.
Why would I put myself in danger just because I want to choose that?
The clap is not real.
Yeah, and I choose not to believe it.
Mind over matter. Yeah, I mean, so you talk about your mother in the special.
Yeah.
And I love you. From what you said of her, she seems amazing.
She is.
How is she dealing with conversations about race in this new time and space that we're in? Have you guys talked about race?
We've talked about race a bunch,
yeah.
We actually did a thing for NPR for This American Life where I interviewed her about her experience growing up in Arkansas during the Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah.
She was one of the first black students to integrate a white junior high in her town.
And, sounds tough.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit, yeah. Yeah, so her view on race has always been, like, a little distrustful of white people, and, like, rightly so. You know, now she's, like, more open.
Yeah.
But she always kind of has, like, a removed attitude when it comes to...
My parents, too.
Like, we're all people kind of thing.
My dad, he refused to give my brother or I the sex talk. My mother had to do it. It was very awkward. But he was always eager to give us talks about race.
Mm-hmm.
And the one convo we had that I'll never forget, it was so weird. It was out of the blue. And my mom and my dad had white friends. I had white friends growing up. But he was like, you can be friends with them, the white people. You can be friends with them. Never trust them. He just was like, never trust white people.
Yeah.
He'd roll over in his grave now because I have way too many white friends. He'd be like, what is happening? I told you.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, not all white people. Sometimes I do get off stage and I'm like, do people think I hate white people? And I do think some people do think I hate white people.
Yeah.
And I don't hate white people, but I do hate
white listeners, we love and support and lift you up.
Sure.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, you're fine. I mean, you'll be fine. Like, you don't need my support, but the world supports you. So this is what I'm talking about. This is why people are like, does she hate white people? But I don't. I hate a system that is built to reward white people for being white and to disregard others.
Mm.
That's what I hate. Don't hate white people. But white people did build the system.
Okay.
So
preach on it.
That's it. But I do appreciate more white people trying to figure out.
Trying to be
woke and understand more that maybe doesn't concern the group that they're in. Like, just understand what's going on. March, do research, ask questions. Like, I love that.
Although I hate when they want me to be the research. They're like, teach me about this thing about race. And I'm just like, Google it.
Yeah.
You got the same Google I have.
Yeah.
I can't, like, come to your house and give you race 101.
Yeah. It shouldn't be the black friend's responsibility or the Muslim's friend or the Hispanic friend to, like, educate everyone on everything.
Sasheer Zamata, formerly of SNL, she has a stand-up special on Amazon Prime right now. It's called Pizza Mind. Yeah, Pizza Mind. She also hosts a live variety show called Sasheer Zamata Party Time. You are listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders. All this episode, we are sharing with you a few of my favorite moments with comedians here on the show. If you want to hear more of these chats, anything you hear on the show today, you can visit npr.org or find these full chats in our show's podcast feed. A lot of these comedic moments are hilarious, but there are some, like this one clip with another SNL alum, that was not funny for him at the time it all went down. I'm talking about Taron Killam. He was a cast member on SNL from 2010 through 2016. And when I talked to him, I asked Taron about that now infamous episode of SNL, November 2015, when Donald Trump hosted. A lot of folks did not like that. Some people said that SNL was normalizing Trump and his rhetoric, particularly about immigrants and people of color. Were you there when Trump hosted?
I certainly was.
I'm going to give you 7 minutes to talk about that.
Yeah. It was rough. It was not enjoyable at the time.
Really?
and something that only grows more embarrassing and shameful, I think, as time goes on.
You say it's shameful. Why?
Yeah, because I don't necessarily, I don't think that the intention of having him on was ever politically based. I sincerely believe that. Mm. But I don't think it was considered the implications that it had then mm-hmm. and could have moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think looking back, it's something that there's no part of me that appreciates or you know, even learns from, or you know, there's nothing good I can take from that week, because he's not an enjoyable person to be around.
During that week?
No, he's, you know what I mean? He's from a different class. He's from a different way of life. He's just.
But it's not just money, what I hear you saying, because there are other rich folks on SNL. What was it about
100%.
What was it about him?
Completely out of touch. I think if I had to presume, because it's not like there weren't many in-depth conversations, just because there was never any common ground, right?
Really?
There was never any, you know what I mean? You couldn't be like, how was your day? And him be like, it was fine, you know, went for a walk. It was always like, my book is number one. It's very exciting. Yeah. Everybody's talking about this rally. And you're just...
The good impresh.
Very kind.
Yeah.
I just am so angry.
Did any of the... So, strangely enough...
At him now. At him now. You know what I mean? At just every move, every... response, every tweet, every stance.
Strangely enough, I was covering the election for NPR the week that he hosted, and they sent me out there to cover all the protesters.
Yes.
So I camped out outside of 30 Rock for a good 2 days and talked to folks that were basically there either to wait for extra tickets or say how much they hate this man.
Yes.
And what I kept thinking the whole time was that there were people of color and Latinos and low-income people who were just like, you don't understand how much pain this man has caused. And I can't speak to their experience, but I heard them, and it felt like some folks at 30 Rock just did not listen to that.
I agree. I fully agree. We could hear the protests during our table read.
Are you serious?
As we're reading, you know, 40 mediocre sketches trying to make, you know, this funny, we just hear, you know... Trump, you know.
Wow.
No, it's tough. And look, say he hosts, say it plays out that I think I'll speak just for myself.
Yeah.
Thought it would, which is he doesn't even get past the first primary. You know what I mean? Like, he's going to be laughed off. Everybody's going to realize that this isn't a real thing and it doesn't have the same weight or gravity, right? It definitely, I am embarrassed upon reflection, just because of how everyone was right. Every person outside of that building protesting was absolutely right.
Did anyone in the cast and the crew and the staff go to Lorne and say, dude, shut it down?
I don't know.
Did you?
I don't know. I did not. No. I did not. I didn't have that kind of relationship, right?
Like no one has that type of relationship with Lorne.
Yeah, I think he's got his inner circle, and he manages that fairly tightly.
Yeah.
I had gone to him about other things, significantly less important things, and rarely felt heard or considered.
Really?
Yeah, that's not the dynamic that's necessarily encouraged.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, I guess the sort of lame excuse is, you know, it was our job and we're hired to put on a show with whoever the show determines, you know, is our host that week. But
it
was not a good time.
Did you have any one-on-one personal interaction with Trump during that week?
Yeah, but it's all just like
I'm sure it's a blur now.
I remember specifics. I remember him being like, you know, he wants to, he's constantly manipulating, he's managing. So, you know, the table read, and then every rehearsal is like, if the line is written, hi, I'm Donald Trump, and welcome to the show. It'd be like, you know, I'm Donald Trump, welcome. You know, I think I should say it. Hey, guys. I'm Donald. This is the show. Welcome to it. You know what I mean? Just more natural. You know, it's like, all right.
So like, I mean,
what a lateral move.
But what was he doing with that?
Taking ownership. It's hit now his idea, right?
Oh.
And now he gets the credit. Now he's like, I made it so much better. Huh. And it was, you know, like stepping to the side or stepping backwards. Like the most heartbreaking moment at the time, we're at the host dinner.
Uh-huh.
And he brings Melania and he brings Ivanka and Jared. We're all at the host dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, Lauren, if I don't win this thing, I'm going to be fine. We just bought this beautiful piece of property in Scotland. If I have to be president, I'm never going to see that thing.
Wow.
And that was his priority at that moment. You know what I mean? That was even a consideration, you know, made me sad.
I don't want to stay on this forever, but, like, how does it feel to know that SNL did that and now is, like, the face of the resistance? And you got Alec Baldwin and Kate McKinnon winning Emmys for their work that is pretty anti-Trump.
Well, listen, I mean, Kate is a genius.
Of
and
course.
Kate is one of the best
love
people
her.
I know in the
Call
world.
Call her, tell her to come on my show.
Okay, deal. I'll do it right now. Alec, I've only good things to say about, only good interactions, and I has been talented for a long time.
Yeah.
It certainly feels like there's some hypocrisy there, you know?
Really? With SNL?
A little bit. And I guess you could say, like, oh, they're righting wrongs. And I don't even think it's righting wrongs. I think the show tries to, and in particular, Lauren's outlook is play to both sides, play to the masses, play to whatever the popular opinion is a little bit there, you know, whatever the mass mm-hmm. consensus is.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, they could definitely, like, mine some comedy out of owning up to it, huh?
That was Taryn Killam, former cast member of SNL, talking about that time Donald Trump hosted the show. He had a movie coming out when he came by to talk with me. He wrote and directed it. It's called Killing Gunther. Much more of that and more SNL stories from him in that episode in our podcast feed. All right, time for a break. When we come back, Jimmy O. Yang from Silicon Valley and Darcy Carden from The Good Place. BRB.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Osea. This Mother's Day, treat mom to Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
What has epic battles, biting wit, and holiday cheer? Maybe Thanksgiving, but also our pop culture happy hour celebration of the action classic Die Hard. Whether you're traveling or relaxing on the couch, it's a perfect welcome to the party, pal. Hear the conversation now on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders. Today we're sharing a few of my favorite moments with comedians and comedic actors here on the show. Next up, two conversations on the challenges that come along with doing what you love. First up, Jimmy O. Yang. You know him from the HBO comedy Silicon Valley, where he plays Jin Yang. Jimmy swung by earlier this year to talk about his stand-up comedy career and a new book he wrote all about his life called How to American, An Immigrant's Guide to Disappointing Your Parents. So Jimmy's a son of Chinese immigrants from Hong Kong. They moved with him to L.A. when he was a teenager. And when we talked,
buzz was just beginning to build about this new movie he's in that was going to be a big step forward in representation for Asian Americans on screen. You may have heard of it. It is called Crazy Rich Asians. But as he told me, blazing trails like that one is not always easy.
So Crazy Rich Asians is based on a book written by Kevin Kwan called Crazy Rich Asians. It's three books. So if this movie does well, maybe there will be a trilogy.
Okay.
But most importantly, it's the first movie in 25 years, first studio picture in 25 years since Joy Luck Club that features a full Asian cast.
It's like y'all's Black Panther.
Yeah, see, I said that on Twitter. People got mad at me.
Wait, they got...
I'm like, this is going to be our Black Panther. Obviously jokingly, because the two movies are nothing alike. It's not a superhero film. But for me, it's like, I hope, basically, with that statement, I'm saying, I hope it's going to be box office success and the cultural representation that Black Panther is. And then black people tweeting me, they're mad. They tell me, shut the F up. And they're telling me, like, why is it like whenever black people got a little bit of shine, y'all got to try to take it for yourself? I'm like, what are you talking about?
Twitter is bad.
Yeah, and then Asian people are like, yo, this movie, it could stand on its own. Like, we don't have to compare it, like, and diminish both of the movie. I'm like, oh, my God.
What does it feel to make a movie like this that is in many ways groundbreaking but is also entering this cultural moment right now where it seems everyone is always mad about everything before it's even there? You're already experiencing that with this movie because some people are saying, oh, the portrayal of Asians is too anglicized or too heteronormative or they're all too pretty or whatever. Like,
and you know who's critiquing the hardest, or the critique that I get for my acting career? Asian people. You playing an immigrant on Silicon Valley, that makes me look bad. Blah, 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 all this. Like, you play this accented character. But I try to play everything very authentically. Even if it is an accented immigrant, Jing Yang, that I play on Silicon Valley, I try to play it. It's just a version of myself when I came to this country when I was 13. And I'm trying to represent my immigrants, you know?
So, well, you wrote in the book something. You basically said, like, the issue is not the role. The issue is the baggage people feel about these accents themselves.
Yeah, perception.
Like, why do you feel so bad about the accent?
And Sofia Vergara is sexy with her accent. Why am I nerdy and weird?
Everyone likes British accents.
Yeah, why is it when a white actor or even a black actor does a British accent, it's considered art? It's considered, oh, he did well. Nobody ever gave Chadwick Boseman anything like, oh, you're doing an African accent, you misrepresent African people. But you know what it is?
What is it?
And this movie is hopefully going to fix part of that.
Uh-huh.
There's not enough of us out there.
Okay.
So everything is being scrutinized. When you're 1 out of 5 Asian people on TV, all the pressure is on you, and you have to represent
the
whole Asian spectrum.
Who are the other
four? I can't name. I don't
Wait,
know.
Wait, no, okay, let's go.
There's a few. John Cho is always on TV.
He is always working.
Yeah. My boy Ken Jeong is always in movies, TV.
Yeah, he's something.
He's hilarious to me. Like, comic, as a comedian, I always think funny first.
It's funny.
Like, you know, it's...
Who else? Lisa, who else?
Constance Wu.
Oh, yeah.
Randall Park. I mean, that whole show. You know,
True,
Hasan Yang, all the kids.
Yeah.
So they are getting more and more now.
Okay.
But it's still, it's like the problem with Apu, that documentary.
Yeah.
You know? it's
this is about the Simpsons
he
character.
He was the most important.
If you're the one, you carry all the weight.
Exactly. So the problem, it's not enough representation. And hopefully, with Crazy Rich Asian, you get a whole spectrum of Asian. And I felt so good doing that movie because I can just be funny and act a fool.
Yeah.
Because I'm not representing all Asians. I'm just representing one personality.
But you know some people want you to represent all Asians.
Well, they want to blame me for something, you know, just because...
Do you ever tweet back? Do you ever write back?
I made the mistake of engaging about a week ago.
What did you do?
And it was horrible. It was like one of the worst experiences I ever had in Twitter. Just everybody jumped on my case, you know, like saying this and that, calling me a sellout, calling me whatever, Uncle Chan or something.
Oh.
But, like, you know, usually whatever I read, it's very positive.
Okay.
I had this girl come up to me after this book signing. It's like, we're very proud of you. You know, your success feel like our success.
Okay.
And I felt great about that. And then I have people, like, you know, tweeting me great things or Instagram message. This kid, he's like, I'm 15. I just came from China. I don't speak English very well. And, like, your book is the first book I've read in English without anybody's help.
Really?
And that's really inspiring. And I hope you keep doing that. So by and large, it's great. And I love all my Asian fans, and they're awesome. But it's this small population of
the
people
haters.
That it's like conspiracy theorists almost.
Really? Because
then, like, you know, when they tweet you something nasty, you go on their profile to see who they are, right?
It's never their real picture.
Never,
it's always some random
Never their
image.
Real picture, yeah. One guy tweeted me.
Uh-huh.
They said, because in a Huffington Post article, I'm like, I'm sorry I'm not the good-looking Chow Yun-fat Asian, you know, but character actors need roles too.
But also, you know, don't sell yourself short. Don't say that you're not good looking.
Right, right. But I'm not good looking in the movie sense. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not like 6'2 and super good looking. You're gonna tell me I can't act, right? Like, I shouldn't be representing you because I ain't this, right? Uh-huh. So then people tweeting me, they're like, Hollywood chose you because they know you ain't good looking and they want to represent Asian people with your ugly face. Or
oh my God!
Because. And then at the end, they're like, because everybody casting you is white, da-da-da.
How do they know who's casting
you? I know! And then they said, at the end of that tweet, they said, F white supremacy. And I'm like, I'm not saying I don't exist out there, but how is that, how does that pertain?
You getting your check. White supremacist about you getting your check.
They talking about white supremacist conspiracy putting me on TV to misrepresent Asian people on purpose. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? Yeah. No Ku Klux Klan member anointed me to be the ugly Asian person on TV, okay? You could go do it yourself.
That was Jimmy O. Yang from HBO's Silicon Valley. His book is all about his immigrant story and his journey to stand-up comedy. It is called How to American, An Immigrant's Guide to Disappointing Your Parents. To wrap things up today, from one of the smartest and most raved about comedies on TV right now, talking about NBC's The Good Place, I spoke recently with one of that show's stars, Darcy Carden. She plays Janet on the show. You've also seen her in HBO's Barry. Darcy, on top of being on TV, she also frequently performs at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater here in Los Angeles. This is a place where some of the city's most talented improv comedians are discovered, and often, once they are discovered, you can still catch them performing there. So we initially met Darcy after one of her shows at UCB, and later back in the studio, we talked about how she stays connected to her comedic roots. You know, there was one moment that I think our listeners could definitely relate to right away. After the show, me and my colleague Anjali accosted you backstage. We're like, we're going to talk for a little bit. And there was this moment where I kind of just have you describe the strangeness of the space backstage. It was not glamorous. We have the tape of it, actually. Okay.
Before I let you go, describe this room for our listeners who can't see. This is just outside of the stage in the green room.
Steps away from the stage.
You are in front of some garbage cans.
I'm standing on some sort of like puddle of garbage juice.
Nice.
Okay. There are many, maybe like 10 kegs of beer next to us.
I don't know what those are.
This is
water
like
heaters.
Water heaters. Yeah, we're right next to this bar, and like servers keep coming in and out of the door to like throw garbage. Yeah.
So you live a glamorous life.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, there's, like, a bathroom down those steps.
And a recycling bin.
Yeah. But like I said, it's nicer than the one in New York that I came up in.
And it just, like, underscored for me, like, I'll meet folks that are making it in the industry, and you're like, oh, you're on TV. Your life must be glamorous all the time. Not so much.
No, really not. And, I mean, when you looked on, I'm trying to think of who played on Saturday Night when you were there, but, like, the majority of those people are on TV.
Oh, yeah. I was like, I know you're from that show, from that show.
Yeah. This is, but, you know, and sure, like, there are plenty of things that are glamorous about that life, but, like, there are more things that are not.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Like, exactly.
And I will also say, like, it's a garbage dump there, and that speaks to how much we love it. Like, that,
yeah.
The people that have come up at UCB that continue to go back to do these shows week after week, it's like, it is our home, mm-hmm. and we love it. Mm-hmm. And, like, bring on the garbage juice.
I mean, and I also found myself saying, well, gosh, if I was in Darcy's spot and I had a clutch role on a successful network sitcom,
thanks, dude.
I'd be like, I ain't never doing the garbage juice again. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you don't have to do used to be anymore.
Well,
what makes you want
like,
to keep
have
doing
to
it?
As far as like career stuff?
Yeah.
You know, it's like I don't really the weird thing about UCB is like it never really was a have to because I'm sure this is public knowledge, but like we don't get paid for it, not a dime.
Yeah.
So it's never been a have to as far as like
it's
I need to.
Stop paying your bills.
Yeah, it's so much about like loving it, and to be honest, when I don't do it, I find myself like going a little cuckoo. Like there,
really,
when my husband and I moved from New York to L.A.
Where in New York were you?
We lived in Brooklyn Heights, but performed at UCB and Chelsea.
Gotcha.
You know, yeah. Like many nights a week, you know,
yeah.
Anywhere from one to truly like five shows.
You said
shows
we, your husband too.
My husband, I say we a lot. My husband is not, he's a producer, but
okay.
we were in that world,
okay.
In that life,
yeah. Yeah.
Very much,
yeah.
Very like deeply.
Yeah.
And then moving to LA where, you know, there's a UCB here, but it it takes a minute to like, you don't automatically just get to do the same shows and,
oh, really?
You know, you have to like...
You had to like re-audition?
Yeah, a little. Okay. Yeah, you do have to re-audition, huh. Which was...
Insulting?
It was probably like, I don't know, humbling or good.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Always good to like mix it up. But yeah, it definitely kind of rocked me, you know, going from doing many shows a week to coming to LA and doing a show once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
That first, I don't know, 6 months was... I found myself like needing a creative outlet.
Really?
Weird things. Like I would be, I'd be like in the car, you know, we sing to the radio, but I would be like ad-libbing to the radio or I would like be writing poetry in my head. I was like, what am I doing?
You
and
had
then
to get
I
it
realized
out.
Like yeah. I have all this pent up weird creative energy that I usually can just leave
put
on the stage.
So have you found a method that you reliably use now to get those juices out, or you just bounce around with stuff?
Well, I think, like, okay, so when I am shooting The Good Place,
mm-hmm.
It is, or Barry.
What's that about?
This is Bill Hader's new show.
Oh, I heard him on, he was on yeah. KPCC yesterday.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, on The Frame.
We had the premiere last night, which is why I look like this.
You look
which
great.
Which is a little rough.
Oh, but listen,
we're
you
on,
look great.
You know, on the air, so you yeah. Can't see me. But anyway, so, like, when I'm shooting those shows... It is definitely harder to get the UCB shows in.
Yeah.
But I almost think of it as like working out or something. Like
okay.
My brain
yeah.
Will
need
get
to run,
soft.
You
yeah,
know?
Totally.
Yeah.
It's like I need it.
Got to keep those muscles
yeah.
Tight.
Yeah.
Did your experience doing those shows change once you like got big?
Oh, I am so big.
Yeah, you are.
No. I mean, you know, it. Okay. So it's a weird thing because on one hand, no, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, it's a pressure that, like, I think I probably am putting on myself. You can, like, there's something that happens when a person sees a person on TV. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Whether they watch the show, whether they even
yes.
Like the person,
yes.
It's just this little whatever.
They become separate and apart.
Right. It's like this thing, like, I reckon, it's
yes.
Just this thing.
Yes.
And we've all seen it and we've all done
mm-hmm.
It and whatever. I've done it. So I have noticed that, like, when I come out on stage, there's, like, a little bit more of a vocal than I had heard when I was
okay.
Not.
Okay.
So you can kind of just feel that recognition, which is not a big deal, but in my, I can a little bit get in my head about like...
Does it put more pressure
yeah,
on you?
Like you better deliver, honey.
yeah.
But like that's only going to result in getting in your head. I mean, and the thing about improv is truly like as little as you can put pressure on yourself and be in your head,
yeah.
The better.
Yeah. And also like it seems as like from what I've seen when I watch these shows... No one's actually trying to be the star. They're
yes.
Just trying to keep it moving.
Oof. And when you are, when one is trying to be the star, which, like, I can't even remember the last time I was in a show like that because, to be honest, you don't, like, get very far at UCB if that's the vibe.
Yeah.
It is rough. And it almost does the opposite.
Huh.
Like, you can feel the audience kind of go like,
yeah.
They're stepping out
this
again.
Guy.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, they're tagging that person out again.
Yeah.
You know, I think I mentioned this to you backstage. Like, the thing that I love about improv is how much of an ensemble it is and
mm-hmm.
How much we are trying to like build each other up
mm-hmm.
And it's not about me saying the funniest thing, it's about me like setting you up to say the funniest thing
yeah,
or
yeah,
whatever
yeah.
You know
yeah.
I always say like you make me look like a genius and I promise I'll make you look like a genius. I think
yeah.
That's like I love that.
That was Darcy Carden. You can see her right now on NBC's The Good Place, also on HBO's Barry. This episode, we heard a few of my favorite moments on the show from so many great comedians. And because I'm in the comedic spirit, I am now going to share with you a joke of my own. Actually, a joke from our listener. I wanted to share somewhere in this episode the worst knock-knock joke I could think of. I think I found it. Brent, help me out. He's on the phone. Brent, you ready?
Ready.
Okay. Knock-knock.
Who's there?
To.
To who?
To whom? That joke came to us from listener Carla Jimenez. Thanks, Carla. All right, with that, we're going to let you go. Everything you've heard today is in our show's podcast feed and at npr.org. Hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Until next week, thanks for listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Imagine a house where every room follows a different architect's plan. Doorways don't connect. Staircases lead nowhere. Lost Patients is a new podcast examining our complicated system for treating psychosis, one that loses patients to an endless loop between the streets, jail, and hospitals. We'll ask how it got so bad and how it can get better. Listen to Lost Patients from KUOW and the Seattle Times, part of the NPR network.